Welcome to Between the Covers on KBOO Portland 97 FM. I'm your host this week, Avi Marr.
T.J. Klune is a Lambda Literary Award-winning author and an ex-claims examiner for an insurance company. His novels include The House in the Cerulean Sea and The Extraordinaires. Being queer himself, T.J. believes it's important, now more than ever, to have accurate, positive, queer representation in stories. His newest novel, that we'll be talking about today, is Somewhere Beyond the Sea. Welcome to Between the Covers, T.J. Klune.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being here.
To start, can we talk about how and when you started writing? Were you plugged into the world of your imagination as a kid?
Oh, absolutely. When I was a kid, I grew up in the 80s and 90s in rural Oregon, and we were extraordinarily poor, like way below the poverty line poor, as was most of the people who lived where I did. I unfortunately learned early on that things that brought me joy were things that would be taken away from me. I grew up in a household where I got made fun of for loving to read, where I got made fun of for loving to write. So I hid all of those things. When I was 6 or 7 years old, I started carrying a notebook with me during the summers when I went outside. And instead of going outside to play, I would go and sit outside under a tree and just write stories, whatever that came into my head, and fill those notebooks up with anything and everything I could. But again, those were things that I did not share with anybody, because if I did, it would not have been a good thing for me. So it actually was not until I got to seventh grade that I met two women who changed my life forever. And they were my English teachers, Mrs. Benson, Mrs. Pfeiffer. And they were the first people in my life to tell me I was good at something. And that happened to be writing. And in my very last class with them, they told me that one day they would see my name on a book in a bookstore. They are the reason that I am here. Mrs. Benson, Mrs. Pfeiffer are the absolute reason, because all it takes is one, or in this case, two good teachers to tell a child that they're good at something, that they did something well, that could change their entire outlook. I am proof positive over the power that some teachers can have over their students.
And the power to be believed in, how that can catapult you into taking action on what they say.
Yeah, it was odd, because again, I'd never had that before. And I'll be honest, my first reaction was something, I remember it being like, are they trying to trick me somehow? Are they lying to me? Are they just saying what they think I want to hear? Which is very adult thoughts for like a seventh grader. But unfortunately, I had been forced into thinking adult thoughts like that because of my home life. And so knowing that they were the people who, you know, maybe it was normal for them. Maybe it was just an everyday thing for them, but it was not for me. And it changed my life.
That's amazing.
Well, you know, what's funny, even a bit of a full circle moment, is that they were both elderly when I had them. So they have long since passed. But last year, with the release of one of my books, I went back to that very same small town that I hadn't been back to since I was a kid. And, you know, this place had caused me so much angst and grief and horror. But I got to go back there to the very same library that I used to go to as a kid every day during the summer. My librarian was the first person I came out to at age of 16, and I got to go back to this library to talk about my books. And I told that story about Mrs. Benson, Mrs. Pfeiffer, and what I did not know was that one of Mrs. Benson's former best friends was in the audience, and she called Mrs. Benson's son after that event. And he told her that he's not surprised, because he had heard stories, many, many stories over the years about how much his mother helped kids. If I had not agreed to go back to this little town that caused me so much crap, I would not have known that.
But were you invited by the librarian, or how?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Not by the same librarian. Everybody that was there when I was a kid is gone. But I was invited by the library itself, and they had no real knowledge of my history with that place. It was one of those, oh, we heard TJ's from Roseburg where he grew up as a kid, so let's bring him back here. They didn't know. And so me getting to stand in front of hundreds of people and tell them my story about what it felt like to grow up in this place, it was extraordinary. It was affirming in ways that I did not expect. And it honestly helped heal a lot of the issues I still had from childhood.
Well, the other point what you were saying about growing up was that you learned secrecy so young, that joy and secrecy were paired together for you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it you know, I will say that that probably stunted my growth for a little bit, because as a teenager and as a younger man, I was very much still in that mindset that I could not share things that made me happy with other people, because I had been raised in a home where that was not allowed. And so it took me a long time to get over that hump, that sort of, you know, nature versus nurture mindset that I was given. But I did. I the best revenge any queer person can have when they grew up in a situation like I did is to live successfully and be happy. That is the absolute best revenge a person can get.
It's undoing any label that somebody prescribed for your life.
Absolutely. I mean, my last name, my father died when I was young, and my mother remarried to a very homophobic man shortly afterwards. And he adopted me and my sister and gave us the last name Clune. That entire family is racist, homophobic, misogynistic. And guess what? I'm the only thing anybody knows about the name Clune now. I changed it into something better.
I was going to say
you're
the most famous Clune now.
Yeah. Right. If you look up the name Clune, I'm the first thing that comes up. I took that toxicity and I made it into something special. And that is something that I'm very proud of myself for, because, you know, I have witnessed friends. I have heard so many stories of people in my community who are not as lucky as I am to escape like I did. And, you know, we think we live in the impossible futuristic year of 2024. There are still queer kids all over the world in rural settings who don't get the access or don't have the hope and don't have the found family aspect of being queer that will help them grow, that'll help them learn, that'll help them be better.
I mean, in some ways, just you're reminding me of one of the reasons I would imagine you're so amazing at depicting so beautifully these sweet children that are sort of held safely in secret. Because when I picture what you protected as a kiddo, you know, your own gifts and your own aliveness, it's amazing.
You know, in retrospect, it is, I think so. But, you know, when you're in the moment, you're not thinking about that. You're not necessarily thinking about the future. You're not necessarily thinking about the past. You're thinking about the present and what I can do to survive. And no kid should ever be in that situation. Kids, they don't have the filter that comes with age. They don't have the cynicism. They should be allowed to say whatever's in their head. They should be allowed to be weird. They should be allowed to be crazy. They should be allowed to be a kid.
Yeah.
And not only that, we should be listening to them, because they are smarter, more savvy, more worldly than we ever were at their age. Mm-hmm. And the fact that so many decisions are being made for kids, whether it be against trans students, whether it be against what books they get to read, why is nobody asking the kids what they think? They're the future. They're going to be the ones who grow up to change the world. So we need to start taking them into consideration, getting their ideas, their feedback, their opinions on so many things that affect them.
I think it's one of the things you do so beautifully in the book is expound from that philosophy, the way that the inspector who comes treats them as something to be controlled, in terms of like, you don't get to think. You should just respect your elders and...
Right. It's about autonomy. It's about agency. It's about being your own individual while still looking, you know, helping a group or community move forward. I think a lot of this gets lost is the individuality of people. We're not the same. Yes, we're all human beings, but we all have our own wants and interests and needs. And the fact that there's no one way for any person to be, because we're all so different and we need to take that into consideration, but we don't. We want the sameness. We want uniformity.
I also feel like Arthur and Linus are the kind of holding environment that kids need, where they're not imposing themselves on them as people, but bringing out the individuality of the kids that they're taking care of is exactly what you're saying, to help facilitate that.
Yeah. And, you know, in the first book, you know, with the introduction to this world, the house in the Cerulean Sea, you know, we have an outsider's perspective, Linus coming in and, you know, akin to Dorothy from Oz, going into from a world of grays and sepia tones to a world in technicolor. And that opens his eyes and it makes him realize that he's nothing but a cog in a bureaucratic machine. But then pushing that one step further with the sequel, I wanted to explore, you know, the push and pull between parents and their children. You raise your kids, you want the best for them. At least, you know, that's how I hope parents could be, mm-hmm. is that you want the best for them. But at what point are you going to step back and let them make their own mistakes? At what point, when your children start pushing back against things that you tell them, what does that look like? How do you continue to parent? And how do you continue to be a good parent? Do you let your child go out into the world and make their own mistakes and find out who they are? Or do you shelter them from everything possible? And that's something that I'm very interested in exploring, because it's again, it comes back down to agency. It comes back down to the ownership of ideas. It comes back down to the ownership of actions. And Arthur, in the first book, was essentially preaching what it needs to be to make the world safer. And then when we get into the sequel, Arthur can sometimes feel like he's in a bit over his head, because his children, the ones that he's struggled so long to protect, are now asking questions. Mm-hmm. And what does that look like for a parent to be in that position when their children are asking questions? And what happens when their children don't always agree with what they say and do? Mm-hmm. What does that look like? How do you respect the boundaries? How do you still protect your children while letting them be individuals?
Well, I also loved, as sort of a central theme in the book, is you can only protect us so far. Mostly, we also have to have a voice in the world and in our own lives, and what's overprotecting us and what is letting us be exposed to the world, both the parts that are going to welcome us and the parts that are trying to hurt us.
Right, because if you shelter people from something for so long, when they actually come face to face with that idea or with whatever it is, they're not going to be prepared. Mm-hmm. And I've been in that position. Trust me, I know that. But you can try to prepare for any eventuality, but chances are things are going to happen. They're going to be out of your control. And you have to understand that, like with Sal, I love Sal immensely, mm-hmm. but especially in the sequel, where he is opening up, he's growing up, he's healing from his past trauma. And with that comes questions. Maybe the way that Arthur and Linus have been doing things is great and it is helping, but is it the only way to do things? Why can't we do X, Y, and Z while you're over here doing this? And that is a central point of conflict in the book, because how does Arthur step back? How can Arthur release that kind of control? He's not trying to control his children. He's trying to protect them. But at the same time, sometimes protection can look like control.
Well, I also love the way the threat that's coming against all of them, when he does step back and the kids say, "We've got this. Let us do it our way." That kind of tension between, do you let them figure it out for themselves? Or, you know, this awful person, they're being exposed to this awful person. You have this parental feel of protection, but you have to let them lead. And their ideas were better. You show it time and again, like, back away. They will solve it in ways you don't know how to think.
Right. And it's because nobody thinks like kids do. Nobody thinks in the way that children do. And sometimes, yes, their ideas are unpractical or off the wall or absolutely insane. But sometimes they think of ways that'll surprise you, and pleasantly surprise, lovingly surprise. And I adore that. There's little moments throughout the sequel and Somewhere Beyond the Sea that are building up towards the bigger moments. There's little moments where the kids are making their decisions, and that adds up to the fact that Arthur gets told, "You taught us, you're raising us, you're helping us. Isn't it time for us to do what you've taught us?"
And I think that's the other thing that's so lovely, is believe in what you gave us by letting us do it with autonomy.
Right. And, you know, that's a thing that I like to believe that most parents will struggle with, because it's that moment of time when you realize that you have made this human being, you have raised this human being, and they are, you know, an extension of you in a way, but they are still their own person with their own thoughts and feelings and ideas. And that's something to be celebrated, not, you know, ostracized or shot down. That's something to be, that kind of support. If I, as a kid, had had that kind of support, my whole life would be different, I think. Yeah.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. So your range of the worlds that you build in fantasy and romance is so wide. Can you talk about your interests as you developed as a writer over time?
Absolutely. So my first book came back out way, it's crazy for me to think about now, in 2011. So that's like, it's been 13 years. It came out with a small indie press and it, you know, it did reasonably well. It got nominated for a bunch of awards. And so of course, that first book of mine was not a fantasy, not a science fiction story. It was just a contemporary drama about a pair of brothers. And so of course, for my second book, I decided to go completely different and write this huge, big science fiction epic and talk about sophomore slump, man. Book was not good. I was not prepared to write that kind of a story then. I was too young. I was too inexperienced. And it did not do good. It was not a very good book. But it taught me some very valuable lessons. It taught me where my boundaries were. It taught me what I needed to learn. It taught me what I was not good at, what I wanted to become better at. And since then, I've hopped around to a bunch of different genres. I've written contemporaries. I've written science fiction. I've written fantasy. I've written dark books. I've written happy books. But at the same time, the through line through all of my books are queer people. My books will always be about queer people, no matter what. They will be the main characters. And regardless of what kind of road that they're on or what kind of journey they take, there will be some semblance of happiness. Sometimes it's the big, cheesy, over-the-top Hollywood happy ending. Other times it's going to be, you know, more subtle. But at the same time, it's always going to be about queer people. But I will say that science fiction and fantasy has always been my home. It's what I read as a kid. It's what I continue to read now. And I have firmly planted my flag in science fiction and fantasy, and I doubt I will ever go back to writing anything else.
Were you writing as prolifically when you had a day job?
I was writing more when I had a day job. So like in the indie scene, so and it still exists today, and it's very frustrating that something like this idea exists, but there's this idea in the indie scene or self-publishing scene that if you're not putting out few books a year, people are going to forget who you are. And that, you know, that was the idea back in 2011. And now the entire publishing industry has changed because anybody who wants to publish a book can do so. You can self-publish using Amazon. It's very easy to do. And literally thousands of people do that every single day. I will be honest, I would be scared of trying to get into like self-publishing or indie publishing now, given how cutthroat it can be. But it's something that I've always wanted. This is what I've always wanted to do. And so that meant working at an insurance company whose lizard commercials people all probably know and despise for 60 hours a week, and then coming home and writing until 1 or 2 in the morning, and then getting up at 6 the next morning and doing it all over again. I did that for years. I do not recommend doing that. I was in my late 20s, so I was not, I still had some young guy energy, and I could pull stuff like that. Now I would never be able to do anything like that. But at the time, I told myself it's because I wanted it bad enough. I wanted it bad enough. So I worked my butt off to get there. And thankfully, I was able to quit my job after 10 years in 2016, and I've been writing full time ever since.
I mean, it's so inspiring for other writers to hear, you know, they would all love to drop their day jobs.
I know. Yeah, I know. And trust me, I was right there with them for the first few years. The biggest advice I can give to anybody who wants to do what I do is that it can be very hard. Publishing will make you want to bang your head against the wall, but there's no job like it. However, do not publish one book and then quit your day job. Please do not do that, because for all you'll know, you'll go into what I did, the sophomore slump, and write a book that nobody wants to read because it's too weird and complicated. The best thing you can do is to build a back catalog. So when somebody finds your new book, they'll be like, oh my God, I really love this. Let's see what else this author has published. And they can go back and see that they've published multiple books. And that's how you can build your reader base, is that when you have a back catalog like that, it can support your work, because people will be looking to other books. I desperately don't wish the thing on authors where all, you see in the news every now and then of a debut novel that was purchased for seven figures is going to be huge and it's going to be adapted into movies and TV shows. And that's someone's first book. I couldn't think of any easier way than to burn yourself out in this industry is to have something like that happen. It's so much better to start small. It is so much better so you can build yourself up. Because when you're thrust into the spotlight that quickly, you don't know what to do. You're not prepared.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it keeps the expectations so high. Good luck writing that next one.
Right. And if people don't like that next one after the big first one, what's going to happen? Is it, if it doesn't sell well, okay, then what happens to the third book in your contract? Oh, that's not selling well either. It was just the first book. And then when they come to sign a new contract for a new set of books, it's not going to be anywhere near as much as the first one was. That's just not how it works.
Yeah, that is scary.
It is. Publishing is very cutthroat. I love this job more than anything in the world, but you got to have a thick skin to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. So how many books do you write in a year? I mean, I understand what you're saying. You were building your back catalog, but it looks like you were producing so much.
Yeah. I mean, in 2016, the year I quit, I released 5 full-length novels in
that
1 year.
Amazing, TJ.
That's bananas. If I could go back and redo that, I mean, thankfully
I can.
Did
you even sleep?
No, I didn't. That's the point. I did not sleep. So now let me put it this way. Last year in 2023, I wrote a few short stories. And in this year, I wrote a shorter novel in February. And that's what I've done. Because like before The House in the Cerulean Sea came out, it was part of a 3-book contract that would end up including Under the Whispering Door and In the Lives of Puppets. But before The House in the Cerulean Sea came out in 2020, I had already written all 3 books for the contract. So I'm like the sequel that comes out this September, that was written in 2022. A book that I have coming out in 2025 was written in 2020.
Right.
So it's just all about when a book comes out. And so I am thankfully right now very, very ahead of schedule. So I can take my time to think about what I want to do next.
Wow. Did you actually write a novel in 1 month? Was that part of what you just told me?
I did. Yeah. See, my thing, I know I get that a lot. My thing is this, when I am getting ready to write a book,
yeah,
I want to be able to sit down and write it and not stop. That means that I try to do any and all research I can beforehand. The research for a book, typically a full-length novel, can take anywhere from 4 to 6 months.
Yeah.
And then I will sit down and write a book in 3 months because I don't stop because I know exactly what I need. I got all the information I need. And if sometimes it can happen, yes, where I get to a point where I'm like, I don't know about this. I need to go look at it, but that's very rare. I tend to be a very fast writer when I get going. It's just the process leading up to it can take a while.
It's still pretty impressive. I understand your research part of it, but once you sit down, I mean, you know, people torture themselves for 4 or 5 years to get a novel done. And I just love this for you.
I know. I like to thank my ADHD for that because when I get part of my ADHD,
yeah,
hyper-focus. Yeah, exactly. And when I am hyper-focused on a project, that is all I'm thinking about.
How does that function in your life? That sort of having all of your attention on this one thing, do you feel like your life is balanced where?
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Oh, absolutely. Like recently I lived in Virginia for 10 years and I did not like it at all because I was about an hour south of Washington, D.C. So everything was politics, the East Coast. You know, no offense to, I there's lovely people there and I had some amazing times out there, but I just do not like the East Coast. So I told myself by the time I was 40 that I would move back to the Pacific Northwest. And then 40 came and went, and 41 came and went. And last year, finally, when I was 41, I said, what am I even doing? I don't want to be here. Why not just move? So in August, I got a realtor. In September, I bought a house in Washington State. In October, I sold my house. And then the end of October, I packed up my dog and my cat and drove from Virginia to Washington State. And this has been the best thing I could have ever done for myself. I live in a tiny little town in the mountains. I have a cabin in the woods on 10 acres. And it is, this is my happiness. This is, I needed this to refocus. I needed this to rejuvenate myself. And it has been the best decision aside from quitting my job to work full time. This has been the best decision I've ever made for myself.
What put you in Virginia, if you don't mind my asking? I don't picture
it. Yeah. Kind of so I was working for that lizard insurance company, and I had never been to the East Coast before. And I was offered an opportunity for a transfer. So I said, sure, why not? And then I left the state of Arizona, where I had lived for 15 years, and moved to the East Coast and did well, I think, you know, for a little bit. And then 2 years into that, or 3 years into that move, I quit my job and started writing full time from home. And it's just, you know, I lived in a suburban nightmare with an HOA. And it was the type of HOA that if you did not cut your lawn, it within, you know, if it looked a little too long, you got a notice in the mail. And I was just like, who are you, fascists? What is this? So I made sure when I moved that there was not an HOA within any distance of my house.
Oh, I don't picture that in Washington State in the mountains. I know other writers live in the mountains there, and sounds more like your life.
Yeah, exactly. I have, my nearest neighbor is a mile away, and it is just, it is glorious. I just, like this morning after I answered our emails, me and my dog just went up into the mountains, up the hills behind our house for a little while.
So is that, I mean, that's another question, I guess, is do you thrive in solitude?
Oh yeah. I'm a very, let's put it this way. I can be a lot for some people, and it is, my mind is always on. It is always racing. And I prefer the company of myself. And that I'm not trying to sound like I'm high and mighty on myself or anything like that.
No, I know
that.
Exactly, it's just, what you're talking about.
Yeah. I need space for my mind to work. I need to be able to have quiet. I need to be able to open a window and not hear cars or neighbors or horns honking or sort of lawnmowers running. I just, you know, it's peace. I needed peace. I've lived a life filled with a lot of turmoil and pain and unfortunately death. And so this is me putting myself back together and finding out who I am as a person who just turned 42.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like you're doing what you need to do to have sort of a healing environment around you.
It is. I mean, my partner, who was the inspiration for Under the Whispering Door, passed away in 2016. Hmm. And it was, you know, it was absolutely devastating. It was grief can turn toxic so quickly when you don't realize it. And I think I was in a very toxic place, and I had to learn to like myself again. Mm. And that's a very hard thing to do. That is so hard to do, because when you don't like yourself, when you're in that pit of toxicity, all you can look at are your own faults. You don't see the positives. And so I knew that in order for me to find the positivity in my life again, I needed to make a change. And sometimes that change might be something small, but sometimes it needs to be something big, like moving 3,000 miles away.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, do you think the grief made you not recognizable to yourself, if you don't mind my asking?
It showed me parts of myself I did not like. It showed me parts, because grief is inherently selfish. It's supposed to be, you know, it's something that happened to you, and it is something that is affecting your life. But if you let it go on too long, it can make you cynical. It can make you, I don't want to say mean, I don't want to say cruel, but bitter. It can make you bitter. Yeah, correct. It can make you very bitter. And I was a bitter person in my late teens, early 20s, because of the home life that I'd grown up in. I came out with a chip on my shoulder. And when I was 18, you couldn't tell me anything, because I knew how the world worked and I knew what needed to do. Mm. And eventually I grew out of that, thankfully, but I could feel myself going back in that direction, not as a young man, but as an older person with a life that they live, life experience. And I just couldn't, I did not want to see myself going back to being that cynical person anymore, because it's so easy to become mired in cynicism. It is so easy, especially in today's climate. It is so easy to hate and to be upset. And it can be hard to be happy. It can be hard to be happy, but sometimes you have to go out there and find and make your own happiness.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon. And I think that's the battle that's represented in your book is sort of, and I was speaking to another writer about this, where she was writing a lot of dystopian elements. And she said, I don't want my writing to be interpreted as permission to not care or be bitter and to not fight. And I really feel like that's so central in the books that, you know, the way that you speak about like staying connected to the world, despite what's terrorizing you about it, right?
Right. Knowledge is power. It absolutely is power. And it's power that people want to have over others. But the more we know, the less it demystifies, or the more it demystifies, everything that goes on in the world. And I can't know everything. I don't want to know everything. What I do know now is enough for me to be aggravated about the state of the world. Yeah. But at the same time, I often say I don't like people, but I love humanity. Because humanity makes art and music, and humanity inspires. One wonderful and crazy cool thing about humans is our deep reserves and wells of hope. We have so much hope for things, little things, big things. And I think that is one of our defining characteristics is hope. Mm-hmm. And, there is a such thing as toxic hope and how it can go too far. But being respectful, being mindful, why are we cruel to each other? That's something I never understood. Why are people so mean and cruel to each other just for the sake of being mean and cruel? Don't you think that you would feel better as a person, or anybody would feel better as a person, if you could just either A, stop talking, or B, just be kind? I know it seems so simple and it seems almost saccharine to say it, but kindness goes so much further than any kind of bigotry, any kind of vitriol. Any kind of words that you could say, kindness always wins. Kindness always wins out. And the people who don't seem to understand that are unfortunately sometimes the people in power.
Well, again, I think that's what the book, is about. You can't dominate and be kind simultaneously.
Right, exactly. And with this, I wrote The House in the Cerulean Sea in 2018 when we were under the previous presidency, because the world was on fire and I wanted to put kindness out into the world. And it just so happened that my book about kindness also included the Antichrist, which, it's just how my mind works. And so, the book came out. I knew the book had the potential to be something cool, but then 2020 happened. The book came out March 17th of 2020. Do you know what else happened that week? The United States, the pandemic exploded in the United States that week. So while everybody was going out and buying toilet paper and wiping down cereal boxes, here I was saying, hey, do you want to read a book about kindness and the Antichrist? I promise it's really good. And I don't know what happened. I'm still somewhat baffled by it, but that book just kept growing and growing and growing. It just kept getting growing and growing and growing until it got on the New York Times bestseller list 8 months later on January 6th, 2021, the day of the Capitol insurrection. So when the sequel comes out in September, whatever happens that day is not my fault.
I was going to say, the Nostradamus of book publishing.
I know. So anything happens in September, it was already going to happen. It has nothing to do with me.
And you wrote it long ago in a month.
Long ago, correct.
Goodness. But yeah, so I do want to ask about the Antichrist and the development of Lucy, because I'm hearing a lot of Lucy in what you're saying.
Yeah, I know. There's pieces of all the kids. I am probably at most, at the best, a mixture between Lucy and Chauncey.
Yeah, but the sort of misanthropic, but in love with good music, and he's so dear. You're so.
I wanted to have an extreme. I wanted to have this opposite end of what anything else could have come before. And the idea of him being the Antichrist was fascinating to me, because when you're a kid, you're not thinking about titles. You're not thinking about what you mean to the world, if anything like that. You're a kid. And so I thought, what if a kid like Lucy was put with someone like Arthur? A kid who is told he's going to be this terrible thing when he grows up, a kid who's told that he's a monster, a kid who's told that he's going to bring about the end of the world. What does that look like when a kid like that is put with someone like Arthur? Does nature win out, or is there nurture? It goes back to the argument of nature versus nurture. And there's, and as in the sequel, it said, you know, those don't necessarily always exist in reciprocity, but what would it look like if instead of giving into his nature, Lucy could be nurtured into becoming the kid that he always wanted to be? I don't think of Lucy in any way, shape, or form as evil. I think of him as a kid who just happens to have spiders in his brain. And I know what that feels like. I know what it feels like to have those spiders in your brain. But at the same time, Lucy can tap into this unimaginable power. And what happens if he uses that? So the point of Lucy, and aside from being just an amazing character in his own right, was just to show that you don't have to be who people think you'll become. You can be anything you want to be. You aren't destined just because people have put a label to your name.
Hmm. Do you feel like you have, that's one of the particular skills you have, is sort of tapping into child mind?
I don't know. Because look, man, I have a semester of community college under my belt. I don't have any kind of fancy writing degree. I don't have, you know, I'm not extraordinarily educated, but what I am is a person with passion, a person who has wanted to do this for so long. But I'm also a person who knows what it feels like to grow up in a place where you are not appreciated and not wanted and are not allowed to be wonderful and weird. I get that. I absolutely know what that feels like. So I wanted to write a book where kids got to be kids, where they just got to be who they were, even if they are a little weird or unorthodox.
Well, just, I'm sure I'm not the first, nor will I ever be the last to say it. I do think that is one of the gifts that makes your work so compelling is,
well, thank you.
That combination of sort of powerlessness around, you know, with around adults and not being given a chance to show who you are, but being told who you are. I think you have a very unique sort of emotional accessibility that is pretty amazing.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I often consider it analogous with being queer. I was told I couldn't be queer. I was told I was not queer. I was told that I was heterosexual, that I was straight, and that that's the way the world worked and that's how it was going to be. There were no queer people in this family. And so I get that. I know what that feels like, not to the extent of, say, Lucy or any of the other kids because of their abilities. But in this, you know, on the flip side of that, it's almost the same thing, isn't it?
Right.
You're being told you're this one thing. You're being told who you are supposed to be when it's not who you are. And, you know, it boggles the mind that there are parents or guardians out there who love is contingent upon the child being exactly as you want them to be. Mm-hmm. And that is just unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And do you think that was one of my questions about the fantasy genre? Do you feel like it makes it more bearable to sort of expose that sort of hypocrisy and that sort of emotional violence against children when you bring it into a fantasy genre? Do you think that makes it that the ideas are more accessible to people because it does have all these fantastical elements and the truth of them makes it that you can reach a wider audience?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if I know the answer to that. I will say this. I will say that fantasy allows me to create worlds wholesale. I can do anything I want in a fantasy world. If I don't like the way the real world works, I can shape my world to however I want it to look. For example, if you'll notice in The House in the Cerulean Sea and in most of my books, I don't include homophobia. Why? Because homophobia is boring. Homophobes are boring people. So I don't want to include that in any of my books because I don't want to give even bandwidth or even a sentence to people like that. What I do want to focus on are larger issues when it comes to bigotry, when it comes to alienation when it comes to protecting children. You know, we live in a climate right now where people like me, queer people, are being called groomers and pedophiles, indoctrinators, and simply for wanting kids to be allowed to be kids, for kids to be able to find out who they are. Nobody is making a child part of the LGBTQ community. Nobody is transing a child. That's not how it works. What we're doing is trying to give these people, this community, stories that they never got to have when they were younger. I want to write stories that I never got to have when I was a kid. I want to write stories for myself and for my community to show us succeeding, thriving, loving, and finding joy and happiness, even if the books can be a little dark. That's the whole point of existence, is to find your place in the world and find like-minded people who love you for who you are and don't care about the things that you're not.
Have you gotten backlash from the right?
Oh, I've gotten backlash from the right. I've gotten backlash from readers. I've gotten backlash left and right. Now, I need to say this so I'm very, very clear. My books have gotten nowhere near the amount of challenges and book bans that other authors have. And there's a very good reason for this. At least this is the reason I think is true. I am, by all accounts, a safe gay. I am a cis white gay man. If you look at the lists put out like by the American Library Association, they typically put out book lists of the most challenged and banned books in the United States every year. And without fail, most of the books on these banned and challenged lists are by non-binary authors, by trans authors, or by queer authors of color. That's what it boils down to. My books are safe because I'm a safe white gay, where other books by Black authors or trans authors or non-binary authors, those are the ones that are indoctrinating children. But here's the thing. If we really think that they're going to stop with just trans books or non-binary authors or books by Black authors, you are sorely mistaken. They're going after them because they think it's easy. It's not, but they think it's easy. And if you don't think that they're not going to come for the rest of us, it's like this whole anti-trans movement that's working its way across the US right now. If you think the rest of the LGBTQ community is safe when they get done trying to do what they're doing to trans people, you are wrong. Absolutely wrong. There's already Supreme Court justices signaling that they feel that the right for gay marriage or same-sex marriage that was passed in 2015, only 9 years ago, oversteps. We didn't think Roe versus Wade would fall. Is Obergefell next? Are we going to try to say, well, it's the state rights again? How many states have outright banned abortion or are in the process of banning abortion? Mm-hmm. A lot. Are we going to do the same thing with same-sex marriage then? I remember after Obergefell came out in 2015, people, straight people online, you know, the witty ones were saying, we solved homophobia. Homophobia is over now. Look where we are right now. We are seeing a rise in anti-LGBTQ sentiments, anti-LGBTQ vitriol, particularly focused on the trans community.
Well, and I think that's the other reason why I was saying before that I feel so terrified right now is it's going deeper into the sort of higher agenda of what a textbook can even be.
Right. Correct.
Coming
exactly.
Everybody. Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
And now we're using, now they're using coded language like DEI and you know, the woke and all of this kind of crap. It's frustrating, but here's the thing. This same exact thing happened in the 70s with a woman named Anita Bryant, who decided that she wanted to rid the world of homosexuals because they were indoctrinating children by being teachers, by writing books. Sound familiar? Yeah. Because the same exact argument is happening right now. And history looks badly upon Anita Bryant, who for some reason is still alive today. History looks badly upon her. How is history going to look on these people doing the exact same thing? I know how I see them now, but what are we going to say 10, 20 years from now? And then in another 30, 40 years, are we going to be having these exact same arguments all over again?
Mm-hmm. I agree with you completely. And I think that's one of the reasons your book, I think you grab all these things in how you're speaking about like taking over a narrative, right? And is a narrative hurtful and does it impinge on other people? Those are the discussions Arthur's having with his kids.
Yeah. And it's, you know, regardless of what Arthur thinks about wanting to protect his kids, he is at the very least keeping them informed. Mm-hmm. They know, he knows that knowledge is power. The more knowledge you have about a situation, the better you can react, the better you can respond. And in this world, with this knowledge comes responsibility, because Arthur not only has to have responsibility for himself and for his home, he has to have responsibility for what his words could do to his children.
Right.
Which is why in the book, he was so hesitant about wanting them to listen to him testify when he has to go in front of the government, because he was worried not only about what they might hear being said about him, but also what he might have to say. And he doesn't want his kids thinking any lesser of him, as if they ever could. But he's still, you know, regardless of what else Arthur Parnassus is, he's still human. He still has all these concerns and these worries and these thoughts that may not have any basis in reality, but it's what our brain makes us think.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon. I felt like you wrote transcripts from congressional hearings, like in that courtroom scene in the beginning. Mm-hmm. How closely do you read the actual horror-inducing language of specific politicians?
Well, that hearing in the book, yes, and the language used was inspired specifically. The whole reason this sequel exists inspired specifically because of the trans community. A couple of years ago, over the last few years, trans people, parents and guardians of trans youth and medical professionals who provide gender affirming care were all invited to testify in front of the government. Mm-hmm. And at these hearings, these awesome, extraordinary people, especially trans people, and especially the parents and guardians of trans youth, spoke their truths. They absolutely spoke from their hearts. They spoke with honesty and respect and anger. And what were they met with? The politicians listening to these basically fell into two camps. They said, either we hear you, we see you, we love you, and then turned around and voted against pro-trans legislation.
Completely.
Or the worst ones were the ones that sat up there with their smarmy, condescending smiles and essentially questioned trans people on their bodies, on their minds, on their rights to exist. And that's horrifying. That is absolutely horrifying. Could you imagine going to speak to elected officials, your elected officials, about the pain and the horror and the evil that is being brought against your lives, only to be ambushed like that? Mm-hmm. And so what did I do? I wanted to know what that was like. So I actually spoke to some of the people involved in testifying in the government.
You did.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it right. I'm going to hear what I want that I need to hear from the people who were actually there. So I got to interview a few people involved, and I asked them all a bunch of questions, but there was one question that I kept uniform throughout. And that was, knowing what you know now, knowing what the reaction was going to be, knowing that the vitriol that would be flung your way, would you still go in and testify like you did? Every single person I asked that question to unequivocally said yes. They would absolutely do it all over again. Why? Because they got to speak their truth. Whether anything happens because of it, that almost is beside the point. They got to go and speak their truths about themselves, about their community. And they got to speak to people who should be making decisions in fairness for all of us, not just some of us. Mm-hmm. And the fact that these people, these amazing people, would do that all over again, knowing that some of the reaction that they're going to get is not going to be kind, is extraordinary to me. Yeah. I don't know if I would have the tenacity of spirit to do what they do. I don't know that I could do that. I can't say, because I've never been in that position. All I can tell you is that I am in awe of the people I spoke with, because it takes not only hearts, brains, and gumption, it takes a lot of internal talking to yourself to be able to see if you're ready for something like that. And all of these people that I spoke to were absolutely ready to do it.
You had such a good villain in Router, yeah?
Yeah, well, and I'm going to be perfectly blunt. A lot. Some people won't like this, and that's okay. Jeanine Router is my J.K. Rowling stand-in. Jeanine Rowder is the villain, and I based Jeanine Rowder on J.K. Rowling and her ideology because of the fact that J.K. Rowling, one of the most popular, if not the biggest selling author of all time, has basically turned and slapped large portions of her readership in the face. Mm-hmm. And somebody needs to do something. Somebody needs to talk to her. Somebody needs to stand up to her. And look, at the end of the day, she has no idea who I am, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm still going to be calling her and people like her out. Mm-hmm. If I use my platform to just tell stories, what am I even doing? I have an entire community that I need to support, that I need to stand up for, because they have stood up and supported me. And it is the easiest decision I can make to return that, to help them, to do whatever I can to make sure that their voices are being heard, that they are standing up for what's right, and that people like J.K. Rowling and people in power who think that they are the be-all and end-all, in fact, will one day just be a footnote in history. That's it. And that is absolutely it. And they will be forgotten. And you know what? The people who fought for hope and love and joy, all of these trans people, the trans activists, everybody who is stepping up and speaking out for trans people, the queer community as a whole, they're going to be the ones whose names will be remembered.
I love that.
Like I said at the beginning, the best thing any of us can do, the best revenge we can get to the people who harmed us, is to live and to live well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, to go back to the book for a bit, it's a beautiful twist that the way that what she actually wants is the power that Lucy has.
Right. Absolutely. And that's basically
kind of vampiric thing. Yeah.
Right. To me, what it boils down to is that people like Rowder, people in the government, people in the position, politicians who gets hired on in their first year to make a certain set salary, then all of a sudden, a few years later, they're all millionaires for some odd reason. Yeah. People in power like that, they get their way because that's the way it has always been. What happens when you don't get your way? What happens when the people that you've been denigrating, the people you've been demonizing, what happens when they fight back? What happens if they're done with your language and done with being told how to look? What happens when the kids who are done being told how they should be, what happens when they fight back? Let me tell you, man, if the youth of today, when they rise up, the people who they are rising up against should be terrified. Absolutely terrified, because the kids, that old adage, the kids are going to be all right.
So you have this gift, like one of your fans I was reading the comments on was commenting on Blasphemy, which I've mentioned before. And the comment was, she said, "I'm getting immense pleasure at how many people would be angry that I read this on Christmas." That's who I picture when you talk about, you know, the youth that are going to determine the future.
That is such a good comment for that book, for that story. That's so funny. But yes.
But that speaks to me about how you're like, listen, the next generation is coming and they see everything.
And there's nothing you can do to stop them. Yeah. There is nothing that you can do to stop them. It sucks that we have to depend on the next generations to fix all our mistakes, but that's part and parcel with being human, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's something that always happens. The next ones that come up are trying to make the world a better place. Could you imagine a queer kid in 80s Oregon or 90s Oregon ever one day thinking, oh my God, people like me, we can get married? We can do that? That happened. That happened in my lifetime. So what's going to happen in 10, 15 years when the next generation comes up and says, we are done with you telling us how we can be?
Right. And they're the voters.
Yeah, exactly. That's why you see so many right-wing weirdos and grifters online posting, we should raise the voting age to 21 or 25. You do that because you're scared.
Yeah.
Because you know what's coming next. You absolutely know. I want change. We need change. We have to, in order to grow, we have to change.
Mm-hmm. You provide happy conclusions that we wish for, that love wins. Is it an important part of social commentary that you're trying to put into your books to include justice, at least fictionally, coming around?
Yeah. Because if I can't fix the real world by myself. At least I can make these fictional worlds that I create how I wish the real world was, you know, where good always triumphs over evil, where people get to be free, where people like Linus get to find a home where they don't expect to find one. You know, that's to have a fat middle-aged, a fat man in his 40s, a fat fussy man in his 40s, get to be the hero of a fantasy novel. That's not something that you normally get to see. And the fact that we get to have someone who is so extraordinarily ordinary be the hero of a book, it's just the bee's knees. I love it. I love it so much.
Yeah. So kind of attached to that, how do you stay brave and positive in the face of the hatred we're seeing?
Oh, well, it used to get to me. It used to get to me a lot. I would get, to this day, I get death threats. I get emails from people telling me that I'm going to hell, that I'll never see heaven, that I am an indoctrinator, a pedophile, a groomer. I get those all the time. But here's the thing. Like Linus, or like Arthur says in the sequel, hate is loud. We are louder. And that is my mantra in life. Hate is always going to be loud because it's a few people shouting desperate to be heard. But guess what? I can out-scream anybody. Trust me. Go try it. See what happens. Go for me. Come for me. It's all fine. It'll be a mistake that you'll live to regret, and that'll be great for you. And hopefully it'll teach you something, but hate is loud. I am so much louder.
That's a great place for us to finish. It has been a joy to talk to you. Thank you so much for giving me this time.
Thank you so much for having me here. And just everybody remember, just it costs nothing to be kind to someone.
It's the wind blowing in the rain.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening to Between the Covers here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Original music from Karen Talumi.
Hiding in the clouds, I don't know why. I hear you crying out loud.